For the rest of the hour, a look at the state of the oceans. Have you gone out and looked at the oceans around your neighborhood lately? If you have, it's not a pretty sight. Four years ago, Congress passed the Oceans Act of 2000, and that act required the president to appoint a 16-member board and members to be drawn from diverse backgrounds to serve as the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy. And the commission was charged with developing recommendations for a new comprehensive national ocean policy. The commission released its preliminary report this April, and as I say, the verdict is not good. From pollution to uncontrolled coastal development, habitat destruction, overfishing, our oceans are in trouble. And for many of us, that isn't news. Well, just last year, the Pew Ocean Commission released its own report, and the conclusions were much the same. So it seems that everyone is in agreement. We're slowly destroying the oceans. The obvious question then, what are we going to do about it? Joining me now to talk more about it are my guests. Robert B. Gagosian is the director and president of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He also serves on the science advisory panel to the President's Commission on Ocean Policy. He joins us from the studios of WCAI in Woods Hole. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Gagosian.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Pat D. White is the chief executive officer of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. He also served on the Pew Oceans Commission, a group which released, as I say, its own report last year. And he joins us by phone from Maine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Robert Gagosian, let's talk about the commission's findings. They sound just like, you know, doomsday-ish here. Tell us about what you found.
Well, the findings, you're right. They're from the past, in a way, some of the issues. Fisheries collapses, red tides, degraded water quality, rising sea level, and, of course, the eroding shorelines that are important to all of us. But what the commission findings and their recommendations are very different for the future. For instance, the major recommendations. One of the recommendations is our policy and governance system is really fragmented. And we really are not very well coordinated. So the commission is recommending a better coordination for federal action and policy development. And in respect, especially with respect to federal investments in research and operations. The second thing they're recommending is an integrated ocean observing system so that we can go from everything from better prediction of weather and climate to better understanding of how the oceans work on a basic level. Mm-hmm. The third is to double the national science budget for ocean research. And, of course, you might be asking, why is more money going to solve the problem? But what we're finding is that ocean resources are being hit harder and harder, and people are wanting to understand the ocean system in a way that we've never done before. And so this is going to take new resources. And those are the basic recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Pat White, you were on the Pew Commission. Did you find similar troubling findings?
Yes, the both reports are very parallel, and the points that Robert make are most appropriate. And I think the biggest challenge is going to try and get additional money for research, because we are now spending less than 4% of the research in this country on the oceans, where it's 125% of our the mass that we manage. It's almost inexcusable for what we're doing. We've just used it as a dumping ground up until now, and we can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break in about a minute, but before we get into this discussion, the oceans are so visible. Why do you think so few people pay attention to them?
Because you can't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah.
If you stand there on the beach and look out, unless the beach happens to be closed, 13,000 beaches were closed last year due to pollution and other reasons. But you look at it, and it's beautiful and big and blue or green, depending on where you are, and you don't see what the problem is. It isn't looking like looking at litter on a baseball field or something.
Yeah.
Most of the problems are beneath the surface.
All right. That's a good place to take a short break, and we'll come back and talk lots more with Robert Gagosian and Pat White. And take your phone calls. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, talking about the health of the oceans. especially along the coasts. Where if you live along the coasts, you know, if you live in the Gulf Coast, the East, or you know, Atlantic or Pacific, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about the state, the health of the oceans with my guests, Robert B. Gagosian, Director and President of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, Pat D. White, Chief Executive Officer at the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Gagosian, you were talking about this ecosystem-based management. Can you tell us in lay terms what that means?
Right now, for instance, the way fisheries are managed, they're managed on a species-by-species basis.
Right.
And also a regional basis. And so if one really wants to try to solve that problem, then what you want to be able to do is look at the whole coast and then also move further out into the ocean and look at the whole fisheries issue and not just species by species. So in other words, look at the whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And in addition, what are we doing? What are human beings doing to affect that? Mm-hmm. And in that way, I believe that you can really solve the problem in a holistic sense.
Mm-hmm. Pat White, what is it? What is a dead spot we hear about in the oceans?
Well, this is becoming a large world problem, Ira. These are areas, for one reason or another, that are dying. The biggest one, I guess the biggest one in the world, is down in the Gulf of Mexico now. And this isn't a problem that you can just say to Louisiana, you've got to clean up this dead zone. It's the size of Massachusetts. And this is being caused by nutrification and phosphates coming down the Mississippi River as far as 1,200, 1,500 miles up the river. So it was interesting just before the break when you said to people that if they lived along the coast to call in. Every state in this United States is a coastal state because everything that everybody does affects what happens in the ocean.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess all the rivers carry the stuff down.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones because I think we've stirred up the mud of the Mississippi here. On the phone is Len Barr, the governor's office in Louisiana and in Baton Rouge. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. I've been on the show before on a similar issue in 98 when you were talking about climate change and how Louisiana is so vulnerable to accelerated sea level rise. And this your discussion today, I'm very interested because I am developing or helping to develop comments for our governor in response to the draft report that you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we have some strong feelings about it. The biggest, I guess, the first comment that we would like to get back to the commissioners who drafted this, what is generally a very strong, very excellent report, in my judgment, is that it fails to point out the very unique situation that Louisiana is in, because South Louisiana occupies the delta of the Mississippi River. So we have the hypoxic zone off of our shore that was just mentioned. In addition, our coast is sinking very rapidly and disintegrating, literally, becoming inundated as the land sinks and sea level rises. So that deltaic process was not adequately treated in the report, in my judgment.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, any comment? I mean, you can go to Louisiana and the governor, and I've been there and I've spoken with the governor. He'll show you a slideshow. Or actually a little video of how the delta is going underwater.
I've seen the slide presentation. It's absolutely phenomenal. Yeah. If more of that could be shown around, it's a real wake-up call. And Louisiana is unique. And it's, as I said, it isn't something that we can just blame Louisiana on. It's a huge, huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it really is. And by the way, we have a new governor now, Governor Blanco, mm-hmm. and she has... She is taking on the mantle of our program that we're playing right now to a massive restoration program. We're trying to help solve both the hypoxia issue and the landscape loss issue because they are related. Mm-hmm. They are related problems. We cut the river off from the delta, and all the nitrogen that's coming down from the Midwest that was mentioned is being jetted right out into the Gulf where it does the most harm. Some of that nitrogen we think could really benefit the marshes that are sinking. So mm-hmm. we hope to be able to play a very significant role in both things, but we're going to need federal help because the problems are huge, mm-hmm. and the decisions that created them were, many of them were federal policies that we had little say in. So,
yeah. Dr. Gagosian, any comment?
Yeah, I think from the point of view of this whole issue, what the Science Advisory Committee tried to do was to actually look at broad issues. And one of the issues that we looked at, of course, was the rising sea level and how does one actually have science-based information to be able to predict that. Mm-hmm. And in the report, as I mentioned, one of the major initiatives is this ocean observing system. And these observatories, the idea being that they would be also not only deep ocean but coastal observatories. And there are a number of them that are going up now around our coastline, all up and down the east and west coast, and in the Gulf of Mexico as well, I might add. And by having a network like this, we're hoping that each observatory will help the others in collecting the data and then putting the data into predictive models so that states like Louisiana will know ahead of time when and how to predict these sea level rises. Clearly, what also has to go into the models is the subsidence of the land masses as well. And then with both the rising sea level information and the decreasing level of the land mass, hopefully one can predict what's going to happen in the future, and then mitigation policies can be put in place.
Right.
Len Barr, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Ira.
And good luck to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. What other places? So you mentioned the Louisiana and the Gulf, big dead zone. Any dead zones around other places, like perhaps the Chesapeake Bay or out in Florida or up and down the East Coast?
Well, the Chesapeake Bay has already begun its algae bloom, and it's already early this year. It's been a very serious concern, but it's also a success story to some part because there is a group of people down there now, environmentalists and citizens and fishermen, working together to try and rectify the problem. But it's going to be a long, long period of time. They've gone down to less than 1% of the original oysters that they, you know, massive oysters mm-hmm. that they had before, and fish are dying, and you know, it's a mess, and it's going to be a long time recovering from
yeah.
it.
Let me bring in. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let me bring in another guest, because as if we didn't have enough yet to worry about with our oceans, there's a new report out in the journal Science this week that looks at yet another potential source of pollution for the oceans, the millions of pounds of plastics that we dump into the oceans each year. Although, you know, there's countless numbers of plastic soda bottles, the detergent jugs, where do they go when we throw them? And, of course, being plastic, they don't biodegrade. And this new study asks that question and actually has found an answer to that question. All this plastic breaks up into tiny, millions of tiny, even microscopic pieces of plastic that gets dispersed around the world throughout the marine environment. And joining me now to talk about it is Richard C. Thompson, a senior lecturer in marine biology at the University of Plymouth in Plymouth, Great Britain, and the lead author of that paper. He joins us by phone from England. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Thompson.
Well, good afternoon, everyone.
All this plastic, you have done a study and you found out, it all gets all grind up and dispersed around the world?
Well, the study so far has been focused on our side of the Atlantic Ocean, mm-hmm. but the survey suggests, because we found microscopic plastic debris down to 20 microns in size, so less than the thickness of a human hair. We found this at more than 20 sites around the UK, right from the tip of Cornwall through up into the north of Scotland. We've also found it in the water column, and we've shown that it's increased significantly through time since the 1960s. So it appears to be quite a ubiquitous problem, and I would imagine it's a problem that's occurring elsewhere in the world. But that's something we need to confirm.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about here in the U.S. These offshore dead spots where the pollution congregates. Is that true of the plastic, too?
Well, one of the things that surprised me about the plastic is that we were expecting we would find some areas where it accumulated, but by and large, its abundance has been more or less consistent at most of the sites we've examined, at sites far away from population centers and sites right close to population centers. We thought we'd find some gradients in its distribution, and we haven't seen those. And to me, this again points to the fact that it's now really quite a ubiquitous contaminant. We've seen some differences between habitats, but not really between regions. We were quite surprised that there was more of this material on the seabed than in the intertidal, because most of the plastic items you were talking about earlier, the bottles and rope and netting, they're buoyant, and you find them at the sea surface, you find them on the strand line. And that's where we started looking, on the strand line. But as we've expanded to other habitats, we find there's actually quite a lot of this debris on the seabed as well.
Hmm. Is there potential for affecting the health of marine organisms?
Well, I've just received funding for another 3 years, I'm very pleased to say, and that's one of the questions that we really desperately want to address. Mm-hmm. We've shown that a variety of small marine invertebrates, things like sandhoppers and worms that live in intertidal sediments and filter-feeding barnacles, all of these organisms will ingest microscopic plastic particles of the size we found. But as yet, we don't know the environmental consequences to them.
And how small do these pieces get? I mean, how down into the food chain can this enter?
The pieces are very small. I mean, we're talking about pieces down to 20 microns in size. And I suspect there's yet still smaller material that we're going to find, because at the moment, the limit of detection for the equipment we've got to positively identify these fibers as being synthetic polymers will only go down to about 20 microns. So the even smaller stuff we're still to get to. So potentially very small organisms could ingest this material.
And is it possible we eat the plastic if we eat those organisms going up the food chain?
Well, it's a little too early to speculate on that at the moment. I mean, one of the things we really need to look at is to see if there's any accumulation of this microscopic plastic in either the feeding apparatus or the guts, as it were, of some of these tiny marine organisms. There's evidence of that sort of activity from larger marine organisms, from seabirds, for example, with bigger bits of plastic. But we don't know as yet whether there's any possibility of this with much smaller organisms for these tiny particles. You have to remember, a lot of these filter-feeding organisms have natural mechanisms to dispose of particles of sand and grit that they don't want.
Right. 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Gagosian, did you expect to see any of this in your studies of the marine environment?
Well, actually, a number of years ago, I was on a series of cruises in the western North Atlantic, and we noticed a lot of plastics in the water at that time. And one of the references of the article was from a gentleman named Dr. Harvey, who was at Woods Hole for many years. And George was actually collecting a lot of this material. Now, in those days, this was in the 1970s, the material that we saw was really quite large, and the technology actually wasn't available to look at the small amounts of material and the small levels and the sizes. But I'm not surprised at all, because with the abrasive nature of ocean waves, this material is going to get broken apart. Mm-hmm. And I agree, I wouldn't be surprised at all if the majority of the material was under 20 microns in size.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. Chris in San Antonio. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question about the impacts along the Texas and Mexico coasts. I am concerned both about contaminants, but the Mississippi is a very big river. There's a lot of smaller rivers that feed the Laguna Madre, and there's the whole quantity issue as the population grows in Texas and rivers are dammed and flow reduces to the Laguna Madre. There's a hypersalination of the estuaries, and then there's the question that I have of how much is that hypoxic zone that was talked about earlier extending from the Louisiana, you know, further out into the Gulf and further south towards Texas and these very productive shrimperies and fisheries.
We're talking about ocean pollution this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me ask my guest, Dr. Gagosian or Pat White, are the shrimpers being affected already?
Oh, absolutely. When we were down there, they were being seriously affected, and the area, I can't tell you exact size of it, but they said the area is growing in size every single year, so I wouldn't be surprised as it will begin to affect, you know, a great deal of the Texas coast. Mm-hmm. But nothing can live in it, so it's going to affect everything in there, and it also, if things are dying, then you're not getting the reproduction that you need. You're not just losing the species itself.
Huh. Is it a seasonal thing?
As I understand it, it is. It comes and goes, and they say when you're out in a boat, you can almost see the line of it where it is.
Huh. All right, Chris, thanks for calling. Is it possible, you know, you were talking about remedial action, Dr. Gagosian, of sinking funding and to actually just understand the science of how all of this works and the science of what's going on in the oceans. In this age of where budgets are being cut, science budgets are being cut back rather than added to, can you reasonably expect, you know, the funding that you'd be looking for?
Well, I think that's a very good question. If we don't make the arguments, and Bill Broad mentioned this earlier in his presentation in the answer and question period, if the scientists don't make the arguments for why the Congress and the President should put money into not only into ocean sciences itself, but science in general, then the funds just aren't going to be there. I think there are very good arguments that can be made, and we talked about a few of them earlier with respect to fisheries collapses, and we've talked about the dead zones and red tides. We haven't talked about invasive species, but that's becoming a big issue.
Yeah,
you know, the ocean is 70% of our planet, and we've gone from a population of 3 billion people in 1962 to approximately over 6 billion now in the world. And the estimates are that it'll continue to go up, of course. How are we going to sustain ourselves as a species if we don't pay attention to wisely managing in addition to protecting our oceans? And it's something that we have not done. We've done a terrible job at it. As a matter of fact, the fishery is a classic example. So I think those arguments have to be made, and they have to be made clearly from the point of view of just the survival of our species.
Mm-hmm. And your commission, the council found that there should be a National Ocean Council, something what, on a cabinet level perhaps?
Yes, the idea would be to coordinate the efforts of over 60 committees and 40 funding agencies and departments and programs into one council. The council then would have both federal representation and external representation, and that council would have a chairperson who would report to the President of the United States. In that way, coordination would be actually, I believe, quite successful, and bring together all of these different groups with the different agendas and really maximize what we can accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And there's no funding yet in place for a creation of such a council.
No, this is just a proposal.
Yeah.
And I want to emphasize that the proposal, the commission report that's out, is a draft report. And that draft report has gone to the governors for their comments. And their comments are due back on May 21st. And then those comments will be incorporated in the final report, which will go to the President.
Right. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk lots more with Robert Gagosian, Pat White, and Richard Thompson about ocean policy and take more of your calls. So stay on the line and stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about the health of the oceans with my guests, Robert B. Gagosian, Director and President of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, Pat D. White, Chief Executive Officer of the Maine Lobstermen's Association, and Richard Thompson, Senior Lecturer in Marine Biology, University of Plymouth in Plymouth, England. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can take a few phone calls here, because lots of people are interested in the topic. Matthew in Chico, California. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. Hi. I got a couple of questions. I was wondering if the dead spots are limited to being just outside freshwater outlets, you know, rivers, streams, sloughs, and that type of thing, and if pollution is mostly because of garbage, plastic, debris, you know, tangible things like that, or if they're biological, like sewage outlets closing beaches, or if it's chemical, like pesticides and agricultural runoff.
Hmm. Pat White?
I think you can add up all those things. We have areas like in Long Island Sound where it isn't attributed necessarily to freshwater runoff, but it is all kinds of minerals and contaminants that are on the bottom of the floor, that on the ocean floor, that have created dead zones there, especially when the temperature of the water rises and it loses its oxygen. So it is caused by a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Is it possible, do you think, that these things can be reversed? I mean, if you know, or are they just going to get worse? Can individuals, if you can't wait for the government to help out, can individuals do anything on their own? Pat, what do you think?
Ira, it's a national problem, and in our report we say how there's enough oil going down the storm drains in this country to equal what happened with the Exxon Valdez. Every eight months, this is the kind of thing that we can work on. We can, start clearing.
Motor oil that people dump down the sewers?
Oil, leaking cars, leaking gasoline, stuff that
wow.
When it rains, washes off the streets and goes down the sewers. People are dumping their motor oil down the street drains because it goes away. They don't ever see it again. A lot of the schools are getting involved in this, and they're painting pictures of ocean fish and thing on street drains. So there is now a connection in some areas to that street drain in the ocean. But these are things that happen inland.
Mm-hmm. Robert Gagosian, not waiting, you know, I guess you're calling for, your commission calls for a strong science for wise decisions. Has science been ignored in the past when it comes to decisions about our oceans?
Well, as Pat mentioned, what's happened is ocean research in this country was funded at a level of about 7% of all science. Back about 20 years ago, and now it's below 4%. So it's basically cut in half. And the problems have continued to increase, so that the pressure on producing the basic information has really gone up tremendously. And we don't have the resources. We don't have the people. That was mentioned earlier in the program with Bill Broad.
Yeah.
And what you're seeing is continuing pressure on the people that are working on the field, and they're spending more time writing proposals and less time doing science. And quite frankly, we've got to reverse that if we're going to really solve some of these problems.
Mm-hmm. How much money are we talking about here? I mean, give us in perspective to where, you know, other programs are on the levels other programs are funded. And now, if you're talking about we need more science, what kinds of funding and where would that money, what kind of research should it go into, do you think?
The funding that we're talking about is approximately the total of ramping up of a total of about $3 billion. It would be around $600 to $750 million in for the ocean observatories, and then the other resources would go in for doubling the ocean sciences budget as well as increasing funding for ocean exploration. Now, right now, if you want to put that in perspective, ocean research in this country right now is around $700 million, and the NASA budget is about $14 billion.
Hmm. And NASA keeps talking about doing sort of ocean research from above, looking down. On who knows what will happen to that program, too.
There is some ocean research that's done by NASA with respect to satellites, but, you know, their budgets are being cut back as well, and, of course, there's a whole reorganization going on now with respect to NASA's priorities for the future, the Mars expedition, of course, being one, which will cost a substantial amount of money.
Yeah, we're taking from possibly from the science programming. Richard Thompson, you talked about the ubiquitousness of plastic. Are you saying that we should do away with plastic containers?
Not exactly. I mean, the message here for me is reasonably clear. Plastics are used for a wide range of almost invaluable products that are used in schools and hospitals and research. But ironically, none of those items are the things we find polluting the oceans. The things that we find in the oceans are disposable items like plastic bottles and caps and bits of packaging. Now, in the same way that you were talking about a minute ago with dumping oil down the drains, none of these things need be there at all. And there's a challenge really to all of us to behave a bit more responsibly about the way we dispose of our rubbish and wherever possible to recycle the plastics.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. 1-800-989-8255. Ian Kerr from the Ocean Alliance in Lincoln, Mass. Is on the phone. Hi, Ian.
Yeah, hi, Ira. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I'm currently running a program. It's called the Voyage of the Odyssey, and we're doing a five-year circumnavigation, collecting baseline data on the distribution and concentration of biopersistent toxins in the oceans. And we're actually the labs at Woods Hole are doing some of the analysis. You know, the compounds we're talking about are things like PCBs, DDT, dioxin, etc. And from my perspective, as a guy that runs a group that works in remote ocean regions, I think what we're seeing today is an equivalent to what Garrett Hardin talked about in England, which is a tragedy of the commons, this common land that is being sort of, everybody wants to use it and nobody wants to take responsibility for it. It's a little early for me to sort of release the data on what we are finding, but I can tell you we're finding pesticides in places where, you know, pesticides haven't been used for thousands of miles. And it's actually interesting. We're even actually doing a manta trawl. We're working with a group called the Algeta Foundation out of California, and we're actually collecting these little plastics that your other speaker, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, even though I went to school in...
Dr. Thompson.
Yeah, Dr. Thompson. Mm-hmm. We're actually trawling for these plastics, too, because most of the compounds we're looking for are lipophilic. They're fat-soluble. And the interesting thing is with these little pieces of plastic is, in many cases, they're lipophilic, too. So in the old days when the idea was the solution to pollution is dilution, with a lot of these synthetic compounds that we're dumping in the ocean, they're not dissolving in the ocean of water. They're dissolving in the ocean of fat, moving up the food chain, and then coming back to that top predator species, which ultimately is us.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you the biggest problem we're having is funding. You know, it's
and your private foundation?
That's right. We're a private foundation, and we've got...
So you have to go out and raise your own money to do this.
That's right. And I'd even like to endorse a comment made earlier. Dr. Roger Payne, he's best known for discovering that humpback whales sing song. It was his idea in 1979. I think he had a piece in National Geographic saying that one of the biggest threats to whales is probably not the harpoon, but was pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Payne and I now spend at least 80% of our time actually raising the funds to do this expedition. I joke with my friends. I claim that I've created a lifestyle I can't participate in, because my whole idea was to get out there and do some of this work, and I'm now spending all of my time raising money.
All right. Amen. Well, good luck to you, Ewan Kerr, of the Ocean Alliance, and good luck on your voyage around the world.
Thank you, and appreciate the show.
Take care. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about ocean health this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. This is like almost a wake we're having here. It's very sad. I mean, you'd think that you wouldn't have to talk people into caring about the oceans. You know, why does he have to go out and raise money on his own? Or anybody doing this kind of research have to? Well, you know, why, Dr. Gagosian, do you have to talk people into doing this?
Well, I think, Ira, one of the problems is that we really don't know what the ocean is.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean that we think the ocean is the beach that we walk on, that we take our children or our grandchildren, and then we find a piece of garbage or something, and we think that that's it, that's the biggest problem right here. But it turns out that the ocean, as I said earlier, covers 70% of the Earth, but it has an average depth of 2.5 miles. But even when you're at sea, you see more space because you can see three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see three-dimensional on the ocean. All you do is see the surface of the ocean. So people don't really recognize the size of it and the magnitude of its effect on our lives. In addition, a lot of the problems we've been talking about today are long-term problems. We have a lot of short-term issues today. But the long-term problems like climate change and understanding how climate and sea level are going to change our lives are going to come back and bite us when we have more floods and more droughts in different parts of the world. But unfortunately, I think until that starts to increase, as like most things with human beings, you've got to get hit over the head with it.
And you've got to get people to change their habits, at least on what goes, as we said, into the rivers and then eventually into the oceans. And people have to have a reason to do that.
Absolutely, Ira. And this is one of the things you touched on lightly with this coastal development problem. And people think, well, it's, you know, a beautiful ocean, but it won't matter if I just fill in a little bit of the marshland here so I can build a green lawn that goes right down to the water's edge. And that's disastrous. 80% of the critters that are out in the ocean come from all this estuary and marshland areas. And we're filling it up at an enormous rate because people want to be on the coast. 20 million more people are going to move to the coast by the year 2015. Mm-hmm. And they're all going to want their piece of the sun.
And they're well, and sure, because the population is getting older and people are retiring and looking for retirement places.
Well, or in our area here, it's working people, but I mean, it's mm-hmm. people from down south moving up here and building McMansions, and I mean, it's the problem's enormous, and it's town yeah. zoning yeah. has to take place. States have to do something. It's got to be done on a local issue. It yeah. should be a local incentive.
You've been a fisherman, a lobsterman for 40 years. What have you seen? I mean, how's it changed in all those decades?
Actually, in the lobster industry, there's peaks and valleys in all the fisheries, Ira, but the lobster fishery has remained fairly strong through all of this. Mm-hmm. As I say, there's been some low areas, but in the state of Maine, we're running, you know, the crest of a wave that we have never seen in history.
Mm-hmm.
And
you mean good, in the good side?
On the good side, absolutely. This is the fishery that's saving our coastal Maine right now, because groundfish obviously has been seriously depleted and will be a yeah. while in rebuilding. And a lot of those people have gone back, you know, to lobstering. And so it's supporting a lot of families that it wouldn't otherwise have had to. But we're three times the landings that we ordinarily been at, so we've been able to accommodate that.
Yeah, just down the coast a piece in Long Island Sound, though, didn't they have this mysterious die-off of lobster?
Long Island, Western Long Island Sound is dead. Rhode Island has a very serious problem. There's a lot of it to the south of us.
Anybody figured that out yet?
Oh, Rob may know more about it than I. I mean, they found toxins knee-deep in the mud down there now. They tried to blame it on malathion when they were spraying for the West Nile virus. That might have been something that pushed it over the cliff, but, you know, I think it was in serious problem before, and it's going to be a long time recovering if they're saying that all these toxins are in the ground that aren't going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long cure.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've just about run out of time, Lauren. I want to thank all of you for joining me today. Pat White, Chief Executive Officer of the Maine Lobstermen's Association, also a commissioner on the Pew Oceans Commission. Robert Kogosian, director and president of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, also served on the Science Advisory Panel to the President's Commission on Ocean Policy. Richard C. Thompson, senior lecturer in marine biology at the University of Plymouth in Plymouth, England. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, Ira.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
This program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer. Our intern is Erica Altman. And a brief program note, join guest host Joe Palka in this hour on Monday's Talk of the Nation. If you missed any or anything we talked about, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have all kinds of links to the topics we talk about. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, free curricula that you can download and use in your classrooms. Also, you can download back editions of Science Friday on your iPod or your Audible.com player. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.